Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I've been doing things the Hemingway all day. Tonight's episode is brought to you by a nice little glass. I don't know if you can hear that twinkling there. Nice little glass of gin and tonic with a squeeze of lemon. And a lemon wedge. And ice. Lovely little drink. I feel like I need that. Actually, I don't feel that way. I'm not really like I need a drink after that kind of guy. Like, drinking doesn't really punctuate different moods for me. It's just, I don't know. You know, this just seems like there's something wrong about that whole, like, oh, I just did a thing, I need a drink. But a friend of mine gave me that gin, bottle of gin, a really nice Japanese gin, for when I finished my novel. She said, don't open this till you finish your novel. And I finished my novel like a week or so ago, and so I opened it. And just now, like literally 5 minutes ago, I just finished reading my novel for the first time, which is such a weird feeling. I'm so confused. 5 years I've been working on that novel, living with that novel, and every page of it is familiar to me. And it's not that long, really. It's going to be about maybe a 200-page novel. Not a real long book. Something like the length of The Great Gatsby, around that length, or To Kill a Mockingbird, somewhere around there. 45,000 words-ish, I think. I don't know. I just finished it. I just feel confused, like, I genuinely don't know if it's trash, or if it's brilliant, or if it's somewhere in between. I'm just confused by it. It's weird. It's a weird book, for sure. Like, it's the weirdest book I've read. And I don't know, but I don't know if it's good or bad or what. It's one of those things. I'm just going to have to put it out there into the world and hear back from people, you know? That's the only way to know when you create something. It's the only way to know if it's decent, for me at least. Like, I can even come up with a joke, and I don't know if my jokes are funny or not. Like, I cannot judge my own jokes. The only way I can find out if a joke that I came up with is funny or not is to tell it and see if people laugh. And it's the same, yeah, that's such a delicious drink, with anything I create. Cannot judge my own work. It's kind of a frustrating and weird feeling. And then the frustrating thing is, it's like I have this paranoia with feedback, where, like, you know, if you give your mum a copy of a novel that you wrote and she's like, oh, it's brilliant, best book I've ever read, you're like, thanks, mum. Thanks. Like, but she's your mum. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're never going to believe that, oh, I've just written the best book ever because your mum says so. And then you extend that, like a friend of yours will read it and say, oh, I loved it. And you're like, oh, thanks, yeah. And you're secretly thinking like, oh, they're just saying that though because they're a friend, you know, it's the polite thing to do. And then people that aren't really friends, just people you know, will say they liked it. And you're like, okay, like, you don't really owe me that, like, you know, like, you'd be, I feel like they'd be honest if they had a criticism. And so you think maybe, but then you're also like, oh, but then again, like, it'd be really impolite to say to the creator of something that they didn't like it. So even then, and then I'll have people that I've never met come up to meet me in conventions and say, oh, I loved your book, it's my favorite book, I've read it 10 times. And then you're like, okay, I don't know this person. I didn't even sell them the book. They've got it somewhere else. And they're happy to meet me because they're a fan. So you're like, that must be real. Like, that must be sincere, right? But then even then I'm like, but they are meeting the author. Like, if I met an author, I would say, oh, I love your work, sort of thing, like, to be polite. And so it doesn't matter how the feedback comes around to me. I'm always skeptical. It's the hardest thing. it's such a strange thing. There are occasions where I believe it, you know. Like I know I can write by now, but yeah, it's just a weird thing, especially with new work. So now I've just finished this book, and I've just finished reading the book that I've just written for 5 years, and I'm the next thing is to, you know, spruce it up a little bit. The things that I noticed on the first read through needs a little fair bit of tidying up. Actually, it's probably a fair bit of tidying up. I wouldn't say rewrites, just like heavy edits in some parts, and some bits are pretty good. And then hand it over to a few beta readers. That's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. It makes me very nervous at this point. Because have I just spent 5 years on a book that sucks? I kind of think maybe I did. But who knows? Who knows? It's definitely a weird book. And people don't like weird things, do they? Because they can be a bit hard to understand. Golly, what have I gotten myself into? Anyway, we're not here to talk about me. You're probably thinking that. We're here to talk about Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. Chapter 12. Sorry, I'm just opening up the page here. Oh God, that's a funny comment by Nifty Rific. We'll get around to that. Okay, questions. Levin is writing a book. Levin is still heartbroken. Springtime. Those were the three discussion prompts. Not really questions, but those were the three prompts. Swim said the mama fishy said, meanwhile, back at the ranch, with a smiley face. And Nifty Rific said, lol. I gotta tell you, I don't know what that means. I'm gonna Google that, because I feel like that's like a reference to a TV show or something, right? Ooh, Urban Dictionary. Is a catchphrase that appears in a variety of contexts. Urban Dictionary, something you say when someone around you says something that has nothing to do with what your current conversation is about, and you want to get back to the other topic. Oh. Okay, fair enough. I don't really know what that means. And were my discussion prompts off topic? Or what's going on? Or has that got some kind of euphemism about it? I don't know. Format Kakar said the real spring had come. The emphasis on the word real looks like Levin's attempt at getting back his life together is the metaphorical spring, and the coming of the real spring should bring more energy and motivation for Levin. I believe the real spring brings a real hope for Mary and Kitty. Too much real. Too many reels in the real. Edit, really good place to bring Levin in, leaving Anna at a cliffhanger. It was nice to see that Levin is getting through his grief and coming out the other side of it. It's spring here. It's 1 week into spring here in Australia, so kind of timely the way that worked. Minil said, I love the description of spring in this chapter. Where I come from, the spring is very similar. I Am a Norwegian says, do we know who Levin's sister is? I wonder where his story is going to go. Has he ever given up on marriage completely? He's distracting himself by writing treatises and everyday aristocratic landowner stuff. It seems impossible for him after how terribly it went for him last time, but those wounds are healing. I still think he might end up with Kitty. Swim, said the mama fishy, said, I didn't see any mention of a sister. More information, please. At the very start of the chapter, says I Am Norwegian, Levin is reliving earlier failures. I also thought my life was over when I made a mess of that business of my sister's I was entrusted with. Maud's version translates this sentence very differently, says somebody 13301, and in the same way I felt myself lost when I made a mess of my sister's affair that had been entrusted to me. I think it is easier to forget about this sentence when it is phrased like that in Maud's. Her farm was failing and Levin helped her out by instituting agricultural reforms, says Swim, said the mum of Hishy. This drink is just going down so well, by the way. I keep taking sips like mid-sentence. Sluggy says, what a wonderful, refreshing chapter after the last few. I love the description of spring and all the rebirth and new life that comes along with it. The Bartlett translation included an interesting note that Tolstoy himself was an avid beekeeper, adding another parallel between himself and Levin. He does go on a lot about bees. There's a whole chapter in War and Peace where he compares the city in this metaphor to a burning, to a dying beehive. And he stretches the metaphor so far that it becomes comical. Like, it's a dumb chapter. Everyone loved it, though. It was a really popular chapter. I was pretty alone in saying it was a dumb chapter, but it was a dumb chapter. Because to me, it had the very distinct feeling that Tolstoy had some real deep beehive knowledge and he wanted to like flex it. And so he was using this weird metaphor about the city being like a beehive. And he was talking about all the different chambers of the hive and the different things that the bees would do during different stages of the dilapidation of the hive. And I was like, Tolstoy, this is a weird metaphor. Because like the metaphor was a lot more obscure than the thing he was explaining. Like, I can picture a town that is getting abandoned by its people and being burnt down and trashed and, what's the word, like, you know, that anarchy when they, like, ransack the place kind of thing. There's a word I can't think of. You know, but I can picture that. Easy. That's less obscure than a dying beehive. But he insisted on comparing the entire destruction of the city, the progress of the destruction of the city, to a beehive dying. It was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous chapter. Starfall 15 said, he is definitely a beekeeper. I just read in War and Peace a whole chapter comparing the city of Moscow to a beehive. The metaphor kept going and I kept wondering when it will end. Midway I became enthralled and was impressed by its extent and details. An impressive chapter. Sluggy says, it's been years since I read War and Peace, but I still vividly remember that chapter. Thanks for reminding me of it again. Yeah, like, it was impressive, the extent and the details of the metaphor. But that was just a guy showing off his knowledge of a beehive. Like, he was trying to impress you by being like, look how much I know about a beehive. But the metaphor stretched so far that it was like, it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. It was dumb. Dumb and impressive. That's what I'd put it down to. I really like Levin, says Techrific. He reminds me of Voltaire and the whole cultivate your garden. And the older I get, the more I take that. Anyone else with green fingers here? I've got green thumbs. Don't know about fingers. But yeah, no, I like growing a little veggie patch, Techrific. My mum's side, spindle side of my family, is very green thumb. Very, lot of like nurseries and plant farm people and they've all got cottage gardens and very, very big, good at growing plants and stuff like that. They've all got little flower gardens and veggie patches and stuff. I'm not particularly good at it. I'm not a skilled gardener, but I do have an appreciation of it, which I think comes from that side. And I've always got the knowledge in the back of my head that one day, if I really wanted to get into gardening and learn the ropes, I've got this like wealth of knowledge with my mum, all my aunties, my grandma, everyone on that side. I like Levin's earnestness, and I don't care that the word has a slight naive connotation attached to it, says Techrific. We need more earnest people in the world. I felt a sting of recognition at the mention of feeling ashamed rather than humiliated. That he still feels so strongly about Kitty shows that his was more than mere infatuation. It was a deliberate choice to love her in the hope that she could make that choice also. R11, tend to your garden and rejoice in spring like Wordsworth did before you. I heard a thousand blended notes while in a grove I sate. Reclined. In that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to the mind, To her fair works did nature link, the human soul that ran through me ran, and much it grieved my heart to think what man has made of man. And later Wordsworth continues, the budding twigs spread out their fan to catch the breezy air, and I must think, do all I can, that there was pleasure there. If this belief from heaven be sent, if such by nature's holy plan, have I not reason to lament what man has made of man? This book has reduced me to redressing a fictional character with Wordsworth, no less. Maybe I need some fresh air. Maybe you do need some fresh air, Tegrovic. Or just, you know, enjoy the melancholia of it. Get yourself a gin and tonic and contemplate life and stuff. By the way, gin and tonic, what a delightful drink. Who knew? I don't think I ever drank gin, really, before I quit drinking back in the day. But I certainly do now. Nifty Riffic says, but no, she didn't murder him. She just banged him real good. Quote Lewis, 2019. Thank you for quoting me, Nifty Riffic. I appreciate that, and I'm glad you enjoyed that line of the podcast. She did bang him real good, though. There's no denying that. She's a banger. That is the discussion of chapter 12. Now we've got to read chapter 13. It's a bit of a longy, actually. It's quite a longy. Might be the longest chapter so far in the book. It's a good 7 pages. Oh, and I'm already yawning. Excuse me. It goes a bit like this. Chapter 13. Levin put on his high boots, and for the first time a cloth coat instead of a fur, and went out to attend to his farm. Stepping now on a piece of ice, now into the sticky mud, he crossed the stream of dazzling water. Spring is the time for making plans and resolutions. And Levin, like a tree which in the springtime does not yet know in which direction and what manner its young shoots and twigs still imprisoned in their buds will develop, did not quite know what work he on his beloved land he was going to take in hand, but he felt that his mind was full of the finest plans and resolutions. First of all, he went to the cattle yard. The cows had been let out there, and warmed by the sunshine, their glossy new coats glistening. They were lowing to be let out into the fields. After he had for a while admired his cows, all familiar to him to the minutest detail, Levin gave orders for them to be driven into the field and for the calves to be let out into the yard. The cow herd ran away merrily to get ready, the dairymaids with twigs in their hands holding their skirts up over their bare white legs not yet sunburnt splashed through the puddles into the yard, driving the calves who were mad with the joy of spring. Having gazed with admiration at the exceptionally fine calves born that year, the older ones were as big as peasants' cows, and Pava's 3-month-old calf was as big as a yearling, Levin gave orders to bring a trough of food for them out, and to put some hay into the racks outside. But it turned out that the racks, which had been put up in the yard and not used during winter, were broken. He sent for the carpenter, who was under contract to be with the threshing machine, but it turned out that he was mending the harrows. Russian harrows were made of wood, says the footnote, which should have been mended the week before Lent. This was very annoying to Levin. It was vexing that the careless farm management against which he had struggled so many years, with all his might, still continued. He found out that the racks, which were not wanted in winter, had been taken into the farm horse's stable and there had got broken, as they were lightly made, being meant only for the calves. Besides this, it proved that the harrows and all the agricultural implements, which he had ordered to be examined and mended in winter, for which purpose 3 carpenters had been specifically engaged, had not been seen to, and the harrows were now being mended when it was time to start harrowing. Levin sent for the steward, but instead of waiting, went at once to look for himself. The steward, in his astrakhan-trimmed coat as radiant as everything else that day, was coming from the threshing ground, breaking a bit of straw in his hands. Why is the carpenter not with the threshing machine? Oh, I meant to tell you yesterday that the harrows need mending. It's time to plough, though, you know. Why wasn't it done in winter? But what do you want with the carpenter? Where are the racks for the calves, yard? I have given orders for them to be put into their places. What is one to do with such people? Said the steward, waving his arm. It's not a case of such people, but of such a steward, said Levin, flaring up. Tell me what I keep you for, he shouted. But remembering that this would not help matters, he stopped in the middle of what he was saying and only sighed. Well, can we begin sewing? He asked after a pause. It will be possible beyond Turquino tomorrow or the day after. And the clover? I have sent Vasily. He and Mishka are sowing. Only I don't know if they will get through. It's very sticky. How many acres? 16. Why not the lot? Shouted Levin. That they were only sowing 16 instead of 50 acres with clover was still more annoying. To grow clover successfully, it was necessary, according to both theory and his own experience, to sow it as early as possible, almost before the snow had finished melting, and Levin could never get this done. There is no one to do it. What are you to do with such people? Three have not come, and now Simon. Well then, you should have let the straw wait. So I have. But where are the men? Five are making compote, he meant compost, and four are turning the oats over. They might begin sprouting. Konstantin Dmitrich. Levin understood very well that might begin sprouting meant that the English seed oats were already spoiling. Here again his orders had not been obeyed. Oh dear, didn't I speak about it long ago in Lent? Don't worry, it will all be done in good time. Levin waved his hand angrily and went to the barn to look at the oats. Then he came back to the stable. The oats were not yet spoiled, but the men were turning them over with shovels, whereas they should have let them run down from the loft. Levin ordered them to do this, told off two of the men to help sow the clover, and got over his vexation with the foreman. Indeed, the day was so beautiful one could not long remain angry. Ignat, he called to the coachman, who with sleeves rolled up was washing a carriage at the pump. Saddle me. Which, sir? Oh, Kolpik. Yes, sir. While the horse was being saddled, Levin again called the steward, who was hanging about within sight. In order to make it up with him, and began talk about the spring work that lay before them and his plans for the estate. Carting manure must be started early so that it should be over before the first hay harvest, and the far field will have to be ploughed continually so as to keep the earth clean. We must hire labour for the hay harvest and not pay in kind. The foreman listened attentively and evidently tried to approve of his master's plans, but his face still wore that hopeless, despondent expression so familiar to Levin. This expression seemed to say, "That's all very well, but it will be as God wills." Nothing grieved Levin so much as this manner, but it was a manner common to all the numerous stewards he had employed. They all took up the same attitude towards his plans, and therefore he now no longer grew angry with them. But he was grieved, feeling all the more stimulated to resist this, so to say, elemental force for which he could find no other name but "as God wills," which always obstructed him. "Well, we'll see if we can manage it," said the steward. "Why should you not manage it? We must have at least 15 more labourers, but you see they don't come. Some come today, but they wanted 70 roubles each for the summer." Levin was silent. That force was opposing him again. He knew that try as they would, they had never managed to get more than from 37 to 40 labourers at the proper price. 40 could be hired, but never more than 40. Yet all the same he could not continue the struggle. "Send to Surrey and to Chefirovka if they don't come. We must try and find men." "I'll send right enough," said Vasily Fedorich, the steward. despondently. But the horses, too, are getting weak. We will buy some more. But don't I know, he added, laughing, that you always want less of everything and worse. However, this year I will not let you have your way. I'll see to everything myself. You don't sleep much as it is, I think. It's always pleasanter for us when the master's eye is on us. Then it's down in the birch valley that they are sowing the clover. I'll ride over and see, said Levin, mounting the little light bay horse, Kolpik, which the coachman had brought. You won't be able to cross the brook, Konstantin Dmitrich, the coachman called out. Well then, I'll go through the forest. And Levin rode across the muddy yard and out of the gate, into the field at the brisk amble, his fresh little horse snorting at the puddles and pulling at the bridle. If he had felt light-hearted in the cattle and farmyards, he felt still more so in the fields, gently swayed by the ambling pace of his good little horse, and drinking in the warm smell, with the freshness of snow and air in it, he rode through the forest over the crumbling, sinking snow that melted each footstep, and rejoiced at the sight of each one of his trees with its swelling buds and the moss reviving on its bark. When he had passed the forest, a vast expanse of velvety green unrolled before him without a single bare spot, and only sprinkled here and there in the hollows with patches of unmelted snow. He was not irritated either by the sight of a peasant's horse and colt treading down the young growth. He told a peasant he met to drive them off, nor by the jeering and stupid answer the peasant Ipart, whom he happened to meet, gave him in reply to his question. Well, Ipart, will it soon be time to sow? We must plough first, Konstantin Dmitrich, said Ipart. The further he went, the happier he felt, and all sorts of plans for his estate, each better than the last, presented themselves to him. To plant rows of willows with a southern aspect on all the fields, so that the snow should not remain long under them. To provide the fields, tilling six and keeping three under grass. To build a new cattle yard at the further end of the field. To dig a pond, and to make folds for the cattle for manuring purposes. Then he would have 300 disantinas of wheat, 100 of potatoes, and 150 of clover, and not a single desyatina exhausted. Dreaming such dreams, carefully guiding his horse so as not to trample down his young growth, he rode up to the labourers who were sowing the clover. The cart with the seed was standing not on the border. It says here, narrow strips of grass were left between the fields, in the footnote. But in a field of winter wheat, which was being cut up by the wheels and trampled by the horses' feet. Both the labourers were sitting on the narrow path between the fields, probably sharing a pipe of tobacco. The earth in the cart, with which the seeds were mixed, was not rubbed fine, but was pressed or frozen into lumps. On seeing the master, the labourer Vasily moved towards the cart, and Mishka began to sow. This was not right, but Levin seldom got angry with the hired men. When Vasily came up, Levin told him to take the cart and horses on to the border. It won't matter, sir, the wheat will recover. Please don't argue, said Levin, but do as you are told. Yes, sir, answered Vasily, and took hold of the horse's head. But the sowing, Konstantin Dmitrich, is getting on first rate, he said, making up to the master. Only the walking is dreadful. You drag 50 weight on your boots. And why has not the earth been sifted? Said Levin. Oh, but we crumble it up, said Vasily, taking a handful and rubbing the earth between his palms. Vasily was not to blame that they had given him unsifted earth, but still it was annoying. Having more than once successfully tested a patent remedy for conquering vexation and making all that seemed wrong right again, Levin employed it now. He looked at the strides Mishka took, dragging the enormous lumps of earth that struck his feet. Dismounted, took the seed basket from Vasily and prepared to sow. Where did you stop? Vasily pointed to a mark with his foot and Levin began scattering the seeds and earth as best he could. It was hard walking, and having done a row, Levin, wet with perspiration, stopped and gave back the basket. Mind, sir, and don't scold me for this row when summer comes, said Vasily. Why, said Levin merrily, feeling that his remedy was acting well. Oh, you'll see when the summer comes. you'll distinguish it. You just look where I sowed last spring, how regularly I scattered it over. Why, Konstantin Dmitrich, I don't think I could try harder if I was working for my own father. I don't like to do things badly myself, and I see that others don't. What's good for the master is good for us too. When one looks over there, it makes one's heart rejoice, said Vasily, pointing to the field. A fine spring, isn't it, Vasily? It's a spring such as the old men don't remember. I've been home, and my old father also has sown 3 measures of wheat. They say it has caught up the rye. And have you been sowing wheat long? Why, it was you who taught us to sow it. The year before last, you gave me a bushel of seed yourself. We sowed 1/4 of it and sold the rest. Well, mind and rub the lumps, said Levin, going up to his horse, and keep an eye on Mishka. And if the clover comes up, you shall have 50 kopecks for each desyatina. Thank you kindly. We are very grateful to you as it is. Levin mounted his horse and rode to the field where clover had been sown the year before and to another which was deeply ploughed and ready for sowing the spring wheat. The clover was coming on splendidly. It was already reviving and steadily growing green amongst last year's wheat stubble. The horse sank into the ground up to its pasterns and drew each foot out of the half-thawed earth with a smacking noise. It was quite impossible to ride over the deeply ploughed field. The earth bore only where there was still a little ice. In the thawed furrows, the horse's legs sank in above the pasterns. The ploughed land was in excellent condition. It would be possible to harrow and sow it in 2 days. Everything was beautiful and gay. Levin rode back by the way that led across the brook, hoping that the water would have gone down, and he did manage to ford the stream, scaring 2 ducks in so doing. There must be some snipe, too, he thought, and just at the turning to his house he met the keeper, who confirmed his supposition. Levin rode on at a trot, so as to have dinner and get his gun ready for the evening. All right, there we go. That's another chapter down. Levin does farm things. The chapter. Have your say about this chapter over at the subreddit. Other than that, thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.